Okay. All right. So here's where we got to step it up. We got to read quick. We got to go through. Like, this should be, you know, fast. All right. You want to lead it off? Read as fast as you can.
We've got Chapter 5 of Book 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring, The Bridge of Khazad-dûm.
So obviously we got to cover the part in the Mazrubal chamber, and then I got some stuff about the drafts, and then we basically cover all the main points of the chapter after that, which is that big battle and then everything that happens at the bridge. Before that, do you have cliff notes?
Yep. So while in the room with Balin's tomb, where they were at the end of the last chapter, Gandalf finds an old book, which turns out to be the records kept by Balin's company of their time in Moria. It is foreboding, and shortly thereafter, the sound of drums and many feet are heard approaching. The company is attacked by orcs, and possibly with a troll in tow. They put up a fight, but they're forced to flee. After running through the dark, down many stairs, they come to a great hall, and a final bridge that takes them to the cave entrance of Dimrill Dale, where they're trying to escape. But a force that even Gandalf has trouble understanding threatens their escape. And I'll leave it right there for now, because it's a scary ending to the chapter.
Oh, okay. All right, so we start off, like you said, they're in this chamber. I think wasn't there like a shaft of light shining on Balin's grave?
There's one, like, tiny, tiny, super long skylight going way up through the mountain to the sky.
Yeah, and I think the movie did this well, too. Mm-hmm. But around it, there's a bunch of broken weapons lying around, too. Mm-hmm. And some of them are orc weapons, which is kind of obvious if he's dead by this point and, like, all the dwarf colony is dead, right?
Right.
Anyways, they find this book. It had been slashed and stabbed and partly burned, and it was so stained with black and other dark marks, like old blood, that little of it could be read. So Gandalf tries to examine it, but it's falling apart as he handles it. And then there's many different authors to it because they can recognize different handwritings and stuff. And then what does Gandalf say?
It seems to be a record of the fortunes of Balin's folk. I guess that it began with their coming to Dimrill Dale nigh on 30 years ago. The pages seem to have numbers referring to the years after their arrival.
Okay, so we're not going to read all of it because that'd be too long. But let's just read like a little excerpt of this so that we can give the people a taste of what it was like.
"That would be Ori's hand," said Gimli, looking over the wizard arm. "He could write well and speedily, and often used the elvish characters."
"I fear he had ill tidings to record in a fair hand," said Gandalf. "The first clear word is sorrow, but the rest of the line is lost, unless it ends in estri. Yes, it must be estri, followed by day, being 10th day of November, Balin, Lord of Moria, fell in Dimrill Dale. He went alone to look in Miramir. An orc shot him from behind a stone. We slew the orc, but many more, something undecipherable, up from east up the Silver Lode. The remainder of the page is so blurred that I can hardly make anything out. But I think I can read, we have barred the gates, and then can hold them long if, and then perhaps horrible and suffer. Poor Balin. He seems to have kept the title that he took for less than 5 years. I wonder what happened afterwards, but there is no time to puzzle out the last few pages. Here is the last page of all." He paused and sighed. This is kind of interesting right off the bat. So, like, if you're reading this whole passage and everything, you hear that this book is super, super beat up with, like, cut marks and stains, you know, sometimes blood and blurry words.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this book has seen war,
you know? Yes.
And it's, I don't know, that's kind of unsettling and sad, especially since we knew who Balin was. Like, we spent all of The Hobbit with Balin. Mm-hmm. And then we find out, you know, he had this big dream to, like, reclaim Moria and, you know, within 5 years it was dashed. And that was 25 years ago by this point.
Yeah, there's also something I think particularly relevant for Tolkien. You know, we've got these references throughout the story of writing books as like creating history, marking time.
Right.
The idea that somebody would destroy the book that Balin and his people were using to record history would be like to wipe them from the face of the earth, you know, like to wipe out their existence, their memory. It's like an extra affront. It's like not just Balin got killed, but like had this book been destroyed, their entire existence would have been erased.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But from the perspective of the orcs, I don't know how many orcs are literate, you know, like this is probably true. Just like it's probably just collateral damage, you know.
Okay. Okay.
And, like, there's just no dwarf to bring it to somebody else to, like, have their legacy live on. Until now, right?
Yes. Yes.
This last page, super creepy. I don't know. We might as well read it.
Mm-hmm. "It is grim reading," he said. "I fear their end was cruel. Listen, we cannot get out. We cannot get out. They have taken the bridge and second hall. Frar and Loni and Nali fell there. Then there are four lines smeared so that I can only read went 5 days ago. The last lines run, 'The pool is up to the wall at Westgate. The watcher in the water took Oin. We cannot get out. The end comes.' Then, drums, drums in the deep. I wonder what that means. The last thing written is in trailing scrawl of elf letters. They are coming. There is nothing more." Gandalf paused and stood silent in thought.
Yeah, so that's not great for morale.
No.
Yeah, super, super creepy. So that Oin, he was also one of the dwarves in the company from The Hobbit. And so it sounds like he got eaten by the water monster on the west side, which is where they entered from.
And that's Gimli's uncle, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So anyways, this is all close to home for Gimli. But yeah, they're totally trapped, clearly trapped in Moria.
It's sad to hear like good guys trapped like that, you know, because like usually the good guys, there's always like a sign of hope and everything. But then... Well, no, here's an example where, like, they were cornered in, and then, yeah, they just met the inevitable bad end.
And we've got some freaky parallels, because now the company, the Fellowship, is blocked in where the water up to the walls and the water monster was. That whole gate has been destroyed, so they can't get out that way. They only have one other way out. There's strong parallels right here, and just in time for them to read that they can't get out.
Well, before that, so... Well, Gandalf's got this quote here. "Gandalf raised his head and looked around. They seemed to have made a last stand by both doors," he said. "But there were not many left by that time. So ended the attempt to retake Moria. It was valiant but foolish. The time has not yet come. Now I fear we must say farewell to Balin, son of Fundin. Here he must lie in the halls of his fathers. We will take his book, the Book of Mazrabul, and look at it more closely later. You had better keep it, Gimli, and take it back to Dane. If you get the chance, it will interest him, though it will grieve him deeply. Come, let us go. The morning is passing." So, like you were saying, this is actually the opportunity to preserve the book, because Gandalf gives it to Gimli to take back to his people so that he can show them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now, at least in better tidings, Gandalf now knows where they're at, and so he has his bearings and he can kind of find the way out. All right, so some book stuff. Originally, he made 3 battered pages of this book, and he wanted them to be replicated and put in the printed edition, you know, with, like, smear marks and, like, cuts and everything and all. I believe I saw this when I went to Marquette to see the manuscripts. I think I saw it. I can't quite remember what I saw, but it was, like, it was awesome. Remember on a bike trip, we tried to go to Marquette? So we did this epic bike trip around Lake Michigan, and it took us, like, with like no training, it was like a 1,000-mile bike ride. We were not prepared. But anyways, and the first day was to get to Milwaukee from Chicago. And then that second morning, we were going to go check out the manuscripts of Lord of the Rings at Marquette because they have it. But then they just had to, like, a display out. And so like I couldn't see it. But I had called in and like begged the guy. I was like, dude, trust me. I'm really into Tolkien. Like this will be worth your time. And he like let me see the actual manuscripts. I think that winter break, because I was coming home for Christmas, and it was like right before they were on break. But yeah, so I got to see this stuff, and I'm pretty sure I saw one of those pages. But yeah, he like authentically, like he probably like, he might even put like the page in the oven to like burn it and, you know, like make it.
Dipped it in tea.
Yeah, super, super legit. Like okay. It looks like the parchment leaf stuff that Gandalf is talking about.
Okay, cool.
Now, also at this point, let's cover this because This has been a minor elephant in the room since our Gondolin special. Mm-hmm. Why are we not calling these things goblins anymore? Why are we changing it to orcs?
Yeah, it's a good question. Because there are goblins in The Hobbit too, right?
Correct, yes. And it's not like they're different breeds or anything. It's like he just uses a different word in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Any guesses?
I mean, it could just be some, like, they certainly sound scarier. It's like a more primitive, guttural word.
Okay.
He's kind of up in the ante in terms of how scary these things are from one book to the next.
That's loosely right, I would say.
Okay.
So, you know, at this point in Lord of the Rings, as compared to The Hobbit, I guess, he was fashioning everything to sound like old English words or like just English words in general. Mm-hmm. You know, like a good example is wraith. You know, like we went over the etymology of that. Like that comes straight out of old English, right?
Right, right.
Like as in the ring race. But just another one, like a side one. In The Hobbit, he used tobacco, but then he starts using pipeweed and stuff because like that sounds more English, right? And so like goblin's just kind of another one that like it fell out of place and he needed to make a change. Also, like you were saying, orc sounds scarier and everything.
Mm-hmm.
The goblins in The Hobbit at points did actually sound really scary, but then they also wore like slippers to keep them silent as they ran around the mountains, you know, like just goofy stuff like that. And it's like,
right. Something they're more out of a children's story than.
Right. And, yeah. And so that just doesn't have any place in Lord of the Rings. Right. Mm. So there's this good quote by Tom Shippey here. He says, referring to the word orcs, the word was floating freely with ominous suggestions, but no clear referent. Tolkien took the word, brought the concept into clear focus in detailed scenes, and, as with hobbits, so that like in the same way he took the word hobbit, has, in a way, made both word and thing now canonical. So he saw the word orc in all his, just floating around in his old English references of, like, stuff that he could draw on, and so then he's like, yeah, let me harness this word, and then ever since Lord of the Rings, orc is kind of like a canonical word for, like, bad guy. You know,
right.
Like just like henchman bad guy kind of, right?
Right.
So the word orc itself, there's two references that he was drawing off of. The word orc goes back to the word Orcnias, which means demon corpse, according to the Beowulf poet.
Okay. So
that's one reference. And then the other old English word is Orcthyrs, which means orc giant. You see the root orc in there for both, and so like evil henchman, and that's kind of just what he becomes. Like apparently from his Beowulf lectures, you just derive the idea that orcs are the infantry of the old world, you know, like the primitive ancient world. Like orcs are just like henchmen of evil.
Okay, that's a good definition.
I actually stumbled upon this too, because based on what we were recording before this, which will come out later than this episode, you want to read about how Melkor first created the orcs. It's kind of interesting because Melkor, he had discovered the elves after they had awoken by the waters of Cui Avon. And so then he makes orcs in a mockery of them. You want to read that?
But of those unhappy ones who were ensnared by Melkor, little is known of a certainty. For who of the living has descended into the pits of Utumno and has explored the darkness of the councils of Melkor? Yet this is held true by the wise of Aresia, that all those of the Quendi who came into the hands of Melkor, ere Utumno was broken, were put there in prison, and by slow arts of cruelty were corrupted and enslaved. And thus did Melkor breed the hideous race of the orcs in envy and mockery of the elves, of whom they were afterwards the bitterest foes. For the orcs had life, and multiplied after the manner of the children of Iluvatar, and naught that had life of its own, nor the semblance of life, could ever Melkor make since his rebellion in the Ainu Lindale before the beginning, so say the wise. And deep in their dark hearts, the orcs loathed the master whom they served in fear, the maker only of their misery. This, it may be, was the vilest deed of Melkor, and the most hateful to Iluvatar.
So now at this point, this is a, I just want to go through this quick because I don't want to waste too much time, but this is a point where we got to reference the drafts here. So at this point, when he was writing Lord of the Rings, it's late 1939. And so, yes, he's come up with the idea, like, the ring has to be destroyed in Mount Doom and Frodo's going to take it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't come up with, like, the full fellowship at this point.
Mm.
So Legolas and Gimli have not appeared yet in any of the outlines. So the fellowship consists of Gandalf with Boromir, who's a man, and then there's the four regular hobbits, but then there's also Hobbit Trotter, So, like, he still isn't Aragorn yet. Okay.
Okay.
So, as usual, no matter the personnel, many of the published lines and scenes that are in the original, like, that we're familiar with, they're in the original drafts, just out of context, and we're not, like, we don't get it. So there's still, like, the birds in Holland, and, you know, it's Trotter instead of Aragorn that's, like, telling Sam to get down and everything. Mm-hmm. And then there's still, like, the debacle on the Snowy Pass, even though the Snowy Pass has a different name. Mm-hmm. And then, like, Legolas and Gimli, who added some, like, flair to it, they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
But Boromir's still, you know, he's still, like, plowing his way through and everything. Mm-hmm. Which is cool. And so, yeah, so some of the names are different. Like, Boromir, like, he's from the land of Ond. Instead of Gondor, he's just from Ond. And then the only thing that's really missing is that warg scene. Like, that's the only thing that's not here up until this point. Like, just okay. doesn't exist.
Interesting.
And so they come to Balin's grave, and he sees his book and everything. And then, again, this is late 1939. And then at this point, he has a block, like a writer's block. And he won't write anything significant for another 2 years.
Oh, wow.
I know, right? like we'll get into it in the future drafts. And I also have to, like, re-look at the dates again. But this is where the one of the volumes of the drafts of Lord of the Rings just ends. Because it's, like, this is, like, a definite, like, he stops for, like, a couple of years here at this point. Wow. You know? Like, this is a significant stop. Like, he got
this was a crazy time.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. 1939 is the middle of the outbreak of the World War II.
Right. But yeah, that's fascinating because he's pretty prolific for a lot of the rest of the time, right?
Well, all right. So here's the deal. So at this point, he had been working on this book, Lord of the Rings, for 2 years already.
Mm-hmm.
And he still really didn't have any clear idea what was happening. Like, yes, at this point, he had established that they got to get to Mount Doom. That's their destination, right? But when the Fellowship gets into Moria, Tolkien has, like, no idea what lies behind the mountains as he's writing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we've had in past chapters, like, some sort of little outline from Gandalf about what comes after Moria, but characters don't really know at this point, or at least the hobbits don't really know at this point, and neither does Tolkien, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And also, there were letters at this point, and this is honestly comical, where Tolkien thought he was writing to his publishers and stuff and saying, like, yeah, you know, I think this... At this point, it was just a book, but, like, in general, he was referring to the whole series. He thought the whole series was three quarters done at this point. Which is, like,
yeah.
Okay, we're halfway through, maybe halfway through book two. So, like, we're about, three-eighths of the way there, maybe? I don't know. Yeah. Like, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, mm-hmm. So that's, I don't know, that's kind of a joke. Yeah, I don't know, just keep that in mind. Couple more notes on the drafts to come at the end of this episode, but I want to save that for the end because that's kind of a massive spoiler. Okay. Other thing to keep in mind with these Moria chapters. Obviously, if you're reading this right, you should feel the weight and ancientness of this whole book, like that they're in this world that's just so old, right? And they're in this, like, great history, right? And they're at, like, mm-hmm. A point of culmination in this history, right? But you should particularly feel that in these Moria chapters, I think. Because they're seeing the elf runes on the doors, you know, at the gates in the last chapter, right? And then they're seeing Balin's tomb, you know, with, like, all the runes there and everything. And then we've discussed the whole history of Moria and, like, how much that would probably mean to Gimli. And then we've discussed, like, the history of Mithril and how, like, coveted it was and everything. And then, mm-hmm. you know, you see Gandalf deciphering, like, the Book of Maazerbal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, like, foreboding senses from Aragorn, like, he's nervous the whole time, but it doesn't actually say why. And Boromir just knows from legend that this is an evil place. And, you know, Pippin's making a noise, then there's an answer to it too, but that answer isn't explained what it is. Especially as you keep going on in this chapter too, like, so many lines that Gandalf's saying, there's, like, unexplained details throughout this chapter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's going on? What's going on here is Tolkien's... Of course, he's making, like, a good suspense, you know, like mm-hmm. any good author would do. But this is also apparently exactly how a philologist would feel as he's poring over, like, old history documents. There's all sorts of references in these things that are not explained, you know. So, like, you're getting, like, the feeling of, like, what a philologist kind of feels like. Like, all this stuff's being referenced and you don't know what it is.
Right. Right.
Which is kind of crazy. There's this good line Tom Shippey has here. If gold and greed and mastery are the desires of the heart of the dwarves, then words and links and references are the lust of philologists.
Okay.
I don't know. What do you think of that?
No, that's great. That's a great way of describing it. I was going to say he's just like other points in the story, has layered on the history and like the, I don't know how, what the best word to describe it, like the extra narrative, like outside the story significance, is just like piled on right here.
Right.
But that's a, it's a great point that we're not meant to understand it necessarily. In a lot of cases, there's no way that we can. Instead, it gives you this sense of like, you know, there's something just around the corner, but you're walking down the hallway anyways, and you don't even get to see what's around the corner. You know, it's like a,
right.
Even if you move through the story with total focus, there's still these rooms that you haven't explored, which is kind of spooky and fascinating.
Maybe it's like going to like a museum and you're actually interested in what you're seeing, but you don't have time and you're just like to read about it on like the plaque. You just have to go right past it.
Right. Or like, you know, some museums, like I think of this sometimes in like really good, yeah, like a good art museum, like the Art Institute in Chicago, where you can't walk through the rooms in like a sequence. It's just like a giant field of rooms. And so anywhere you turn, you know you're missing something else. And it's kind of stressful, but it's also exciting because there's always something hiding behind every corner. Gandalf had hardly spoken these words when there came a great noise, a rolling boom that seemed to come from the depths far below and to tremble in the stone at their feet. They sprang towards the door in alarm. Doom! Doom! It rolled again, as if huge hands were turning the very caverns of Moria into a vast drum. Then there came an echoing blast. A great horn was blown in the hall, and answering horns and harsh cries were heard further off. There was a hurrying sound of many feet. "They are coming," cried Legolas. "We cannot get out," said Gimli. "Trapped," cried Gandalf. "Why did I delay? Here we are, caught, just as they were before. But I was not there then. We will see what..." Doom, doom, came the drum beat, and the walls shook.
Just like in the book that they just read, you know, they're trapped on all sides, apparently. So we'll see what happens here. We can't read all this, so let's just keep going.
"There are many orcs, very many of them," he said, "and some are large and evil, black Uruks of Mordor. For the moment they are hanging back, but there is something else there. A great cave troll, I think, or more than one. There is no hope of escape that way." "And no hope at all if they come at the other door as well," said Boromir. "There is no sound outside here yet," said Aragorn, who was standing by the eastern door listening. "The passage on this side plunges straight down a stair. It plainly does not lead back towards the hall. But it is no good flying blindly this way with the pursuit just behind. We cannot block the door. Its key is gone and the lock is broken, and it opens inwards. We must do something to delay the enemy first. We will make them fear the chamber of Mazarbul," he said grimly, feeling the edge of his sword and Duriel.
That's badass. Okay, so they end up blocking the door, and like the movie just does a good job with this whole scene, I would say, personally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. "There was a blow on the door that made it quiver, and it began to grind slowly open, driving back the wedges. A huge arm and shoulder, with dark skin of greenish scales, was thrust through the widening gap.
There was a crash on the door, followed by crash after crash. Rams and hammers were beating against it. It cracked and staggered back, and the opening grew suddenly wide. Arrows came whistling in, but struck the northern wall and fell harmlessly to the floor. There was a horn blast and a rush of feet, and orcs one after another leapt into the chamber. How many there were, the company could not count. The affray was sharp, but the orcs were dismayed by the fierceness of the defense. Legolas shot two through the throat. Gimli hewed the legs from another that had sprung up on Balin's tomb. Boromir and Aragorn slew many. When 13 had fallen, the rest fled shrieking, leaving the defenders unharmed, except for Sam, who had a scratch across the scalp. A quick duck had saved him, and he had felled this orc, a sturdy thrust with his barrow blade. A fire was smoldering in his brown eyes that would have made Ted Sandyman step backwards if he had seen it.
"Now is the time," cried Gandalf. "Let us go, before the troll returns."
But even as they retreated, and before Pippin and Merry had reached the stair outside, a huge orc chieftain, almost man-high, clad in black mail from head to foot, leapt into the chamber. Behind him his followers clustered in the doorway. His broad, flat face was swart, his eyes were like coals, and his tongue was red. He wielded a great spear. With a thrust of his huge hide shield, he turned Boromir's sword and bore him backwards, throwing him to the ground. Diving under Aragorn's blow with the speed of a striking snake, he charged into the company and thrust with his spear straight at Frodo. The blow caught him on the right side, and Frodo was hurled against the wall and pinned. Sam, with a cry, hacked at the spear shaft, and it broke. But even as the orcs flung down the truncheon and swept out his scimitar, Anduril came down upon his helm. There was a flash like a flame, and the helm burst asunder. The orc fell with a cloven head. His followers fled howling as Boromir and Aragorn sprang at them. Doom, doom went the drums in the deep. The great voice rolled out again.
Now, shouted Gandalf, now is the last chance. Run for it. At this point, they haul out. Gandalf says, swords are no more use here, you know that famous line. Aragorn's carrying Frodo, but Frodo ends up waking up, and he says he's all right, even though everybody thought he was dead. So they feel their way down in pitch black darkness down a staircase, but Gandalf's still at the top of the stairs at this point. And so Gandalf chants some sort of spell, and then you want to take it.
Suddenly at the top of the stair, there was a stab of white light. Then there was a dull rumble and a heavy thud. The drum beats broke out wildly. Doom boom, doom boom, and then stopped. Gandalf came flying down the steps and fell to the ground in the midst of the company.
Well, well, that's over, said the wizard, struggling to his feet. I have done all that I could, but I have met my match and have nearly been destroyed. But don't stand here. Go on. You will have to do without light for a while. I am rather shaken. Go on, go on. Where are you, Gimli? Come ahead with me. Keep close behind, all of you. So, that's kind of interesting. We're hearing some big stuff. Gandalf's met his match?
Yeah, we've never heard anything like that before.
Right, and he's, like, super, super, like, energy spent. You know, like, mm-hmm. If you're in a video game, he has no speed boost for Mario Kart, or he has no, like, force power in, like, a Star Wars video game.
He can't even make his staff light up, which we presume is pretty low.
So at this point, we got to think, like, he's just run, like, his 5K PR, right? If we're relating this to cross-country. Uh-huh. At least his 5K PR, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he's super, super spent.
Or maybe, like, he thought he was running his PR and he tripped partway through and he's just, like, in a daze.
Oh, well, I think he's literally done it.
Okay.
All right, anyways, let's keep going. So they seem to be making good progress in the dark and they're undisturbed, which is nice because they were just in a huge battle above that we brushed through. Mm-hmm, all right,
mm-hmm.
Gandalf thinks at this point they're probably at ground level and so they just got to cut straight east and get the hell out of this mountain. But he's still super, super tired and they keep pointing on this to the point where it's like, I don't think this is just a 5K PR tired. I think this is like marathon PR tired.
Mm-hmm.
Gandalf says, I must rest a moment, even if all the orcs ever spawned are after us. So yeah, marathon PR tired.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Gimli says, well, what happened in the doorway there? Do you want to take what Gandalf says?
I do not know, answered Gandalf, but I found myself suddenly faced by something that I have not met before. I could think of nothing to do but to try and put a shutting spell on the door. I know many, but to do things of that kind rightly requires time, and even then the door can still be broken by strength. As I stood there, I could hear orc voices on the other side. At any moment, I thought they would burst it open. I could not hear what it was said. They seemed to be talking in their own hideous language. All I caught was gash, that is, fire. Then something came into the chamber. I felt it through the door, and the orcs themselves were afraid and silent. It laid hold of the iron ring, and then it perceived me and my spell. What it was, I cannot guess, but I have never felt such a challenge. The counterspell was terrible. It nearly broke me. For an instant, the door left my control and began to open. I had to speak a word of command. That proved too great a strain. The door burst into pieces. Something dark as a cloud was blocking all the light inside, and I was thrown backwards down the stairs. All the wall gave way, and the roof of the chamber as well, I think. Yeah.
So from that, it sounds like the whole passage was completely blocked to any sort of enemies, which sounds like best case scenario, besides that Balin's grave was probably destroyed and his dead body was disturbed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this is also like very foreboding, especially that part where the orcs are shrieking about, what is it, Gnash,
mm-hmm.
which translates to fire. So mm-hmm. that's kind of creepy. Anyways, though, Gandalf's still interested, like, what about you, Frodo? Because Gandalf and everybody else assumed he was dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Frodo's just like, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. You know, let's just move on. But Aragorn's super impressed. You know, like, he has that famous line from the movie, like, that spear thrust would have skewered a wild boar, you know? And like, or like, when I met you in Bree, I didn't think you were made of such stern stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
And then what does Gandalf say there?
You take after Bilbo, said Gandalf. There is more about you than meets the eye, as I said of him long ago. Frodo wondered if the remark meant more than it said.
And obviously, since Tolkien's a good writer, yes, Gandalf meant more than just physically.
Yes.
Okay, so now we come to the final part here.
They now went on again. Before long, Gimli spoke. He had keen eyes in the dark.
I think he said that there is a light ahead, but it is not daylight. It is red. What can it be? Gosh, muttered Gandalf. I wonder if that is what they meant, that the lower levels are on fire. Still, we can only go on.
Soon the light became unmistakable and could be seen by all. It was flickering and glowing on the walls away down the passage before them. They could now see their way. In front, the road sloped down swiftly, and some way ahead, there stood a low archway. Through it, the glowing light came. The air became very hot. When they came to the arch, Gandalf went through, signing to them to wait. As he stood just before the opening, they saw his face lit by a red glow. Quickly, he stepped back.
There is some new devilry here, he said. Devised for our welcome, no doubt. But I know where we are. Okay, so at this point, Gandalf tells them the exact route out. They're very close. This is the final lap. Okay, so at this point, they got across a massive cavern hall again, bigger than the hall that they were in the last chapter where the light was shining through. And there's a line of fire, but since they've taken a side passage, they've actually passed it. So like this line of fire is like a last like kind of defense that they can't like jump over. You know, it's wider than that. This line of fire just protects everybody.
And point being, it was supposed to be in their way. It's actually behind them now, and it's blocking their pursuers.
If they had taken the main path of Moria, they would have come across it and then not been able to cross it. But yes, the side passages led them out past it, and all their enemies are on the other side of it, which is convenient.
Now for the last race, said Gandalf. If the sun is shining outside, we may still escape. After me. He turned left and sped across the smooth floor of the hall. The distance was greater than it had looked. As they ran, they heard the beat and echo of many hurrying feet behind. A shrill yell went up. They had been seen. There was a ring and clash of steel. An arrow whistled over Frodo's head.
Boromir laughed. They did not expect this, he said. The fire has cut them off. We are on the wrong side. Look ahead, called Gandalf. The bridge is near. It is dangerous and narrow.
Suddenly, Frodo saw before him a black chasm. At the end of the hall, the floor vanished and fell to an unknown depth. The outer door could only be reached by a slender bridge of stone without curb or rail that spanned the chasm with one curving spring of 50 feet. It was an ancient defense of the dwarves against any enemy that might capture the first hall and the outer passages. They could only pass along it in single file. At the brink, Gandalf halted, and the others came up in a pack behind.
Lead the way, Gimli, he said. Pippin and Merry next. Straight on, and up the stair beyond the door.
Arrows fell among them. One struck Frodo and sprang back. Another pierced Gandalf's hat and stuck there like a black feather. Frodo looked behind. Beyond the fire, he saw swarming black figures. There seemed to be hundreds of orcs. They brandished spears and scimitars which shone red as blood in the firelight. Doom, doom, rolled the drum beats, growing louder and louder. Doom, doom. Legolas turned and set an arrow to the string, though it was a long shot for a small bow. He drew, but his hand fell, and the arrow slipped to the ground. He gave a cry of dismay and fear. Two great trolls appeared. They bore great slabs of stone and flung them down to serve as gangways over the fire. But it was not the trolls that had filled the elf with terror. The ranks of the orcs had opened, and they crowded away, as if they themselves were afraid. Something was coming up behind them. What it was could not be seen. It was like a great shadow, in the middle of which was a dark form, of man-shape maybe, yet greater, and a power and terror seemed to be in it and to go before it. It came to the edge of the fire, and the light faded as if a cloud had bent over it. Then with a rush it leapt across the fissure. The flames roared up to greet it, and wreathed about it, and black smoke swirled in the air. Its streaming mane kindled and blazed behind it. In its right hand was a blade like a stabbing tongue of fire, and in its left it held a whip of many thongs.
Aye, aye, wailed Legolas. A Balrog is come. Gimli stared with wide eyes. Durin's Bane, he cried. Letting his axe fall, he covered his face. A Balrog, muttered Gandalf. Now I understand, he faltered, and leaned heavily on his staff. What an evil fortune, and I am already weary. Everybody with us so far?
Yeah, so basically, they're almost out. They just have to go over this long bridge over a giant chasm. Meanwhile, behind them, the orcs and the trolls are hot on their tails, but they make way for a Balrog, which is an heretofore undescribed figure in Lord of the Rings, although we know it from the Silmarillion.
Right, we know it in the Silmarillion. Like, we've seen how deadly those things are, and now there's one here, and those things, like, maybe armies can maybe stand a chance against these things, as opposed to the 9 Fellowship Companions. This is a big deal. And Gandalf, like we said, he's just run his marathon PR, so he's tired. And he says it himself, like, wow, I'm already tired, and now I gotta face this thing. Oh, crap.
Right, right. And he's weary just from trying to put a spell up against one of these things.
Right, that's what he was guarding against when that whole chamber fell down upon him. You want to take this, though? Let's finish this off.
The dark figure streaming with fire raced towards them. The orcs yelled and poured over the stone gangways. Then Boromir raised his horn and blew. Loud the challenge rang and bellowed, like the shout of many throats under the cavernous roof. For a moment, the orcs quailed and the fiery shadow halted. Then the echoes died as suddenly as a flame blown up by a dark wind, and the enemy advanced again.
Over the bridge, cried Gandalf, recalling his strength. Fly! This is a foe beyond any of you. I must hold the narrow way. Fly! Aragorn and Boromir did not heed the command, but still held their ground, side by side. Behind Gandalf, at the far end of the bridge, the others halted just within the doorway of the hall's end, and turned, unable to leave their leader to face the enemy alone.
The Balrog reached the bridge. Gandalf stood in the middle of the span, leaning on the staff in his left hand, but in his other hand Glamdring gleamed, cold and white. His enemy halted again, and facing him, and the shadow about it reached out like two vast wings. It raised a whip, and the thongs twined and cracked. Fire came from its nostrils, but Gandalf stood firm.
You cannot pass, he said. The orcs stood still, and a dead silence fell. I am the servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Arnor. You cannot pass. The dark fire will not avail you, flame of Unan. Go back to the shadow. You cannot pass.
The Balrog made no answer. The fire in it seemed to die, but the darkness grew. It stepped forward slowly on the bridge, and suddenly it drew itself up to a great height, and its wings were spread from wall to wall. But still Gandalf could be seen, glimmering in the gloom. He seemed small and altogether alone, gray and bent, like a wizened tree before the onset of a storm. From out of the shadow a red sword leaped flaming. Glamdring glittered white in answer. There was a ringing clash and a stab of white fire. The Balrog fell back and its sword flew up in molten fragments. The wizard swayed on the bridge, stepped back a pace, and then stood again still.
You cannot pass, he said.
With a bound, the Balrog leaped full upon the bridge. Its whip whirled and hissed.
He cannot stand alone, cried Aragorn suddenly, and ran back along the bridge. Elendil, he shouted. I am with you, Gandalf. Gondor, cried Boromir, and he leapt after him.
At that moment, Gandalf lifted his staff, and crying aloud, he smote the bridge before him. The staff broke asunder and fell from his hand. A blinding sheet of white flame sprang up. The bridge cracked. Right at the Balrog's feet it broke, and the stone upon which it stood crashed into the gulf, while the rest remained, poised, quivering like a tongue of rock thrust into emptiness. With a terrible cry, the Balrog fell forward, and its shadow plunged down and vanished. But even as it fell, it swung its whip, and the thongs lashed and curled about the wizard's knees, dragging him to the brink. He staggered and fell, grasped vainly at the stone, and slid into the abyss.
Fly, you fools, he cried, and he was gone.
The fires went out, and blank darkness fell. The company stood rooted with horror, staring into the pit. Even as Aragorn and Boromir came flying back, the rest of the bridge cracked and fell. With a cry, Aragorn roused them.
Come, I will lead you now, he called. We must obey his last command. Follow me.
They stumbled wildly up the great stairs beyond the door, Aragorn leading, Boromir at the rear. At the top was a wide, echoing passage. Along this they fled. Frodo heard Sam at his side weeping, and then he found that he himself was weeping as he ran. Doom, 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 the drumbeats rolled behind, mournful now and slow. Doom. They ran on. The light grew before them. Great shafts pierced the roof. They ran swifter. They passed into a hall, bright with daylight from its high windows in the east. They fled across it. Through its huge broken doors they passed, and suddenly before them the great gates opened, an arch of blazing light. There was a guard of orcs crouching in the shadows behind the great doorpost, towering on either side. But the gates were shattered and cast down. Aragorn smote to the ground the captain that stood in his path, and the rest fled in terror of his wrath. The company swept past them and took no heed of them. Out of the gates they ran and sprang down the huge and age-worn steps, the threshold of Moria. Thus, at last, they came beyond hope under the sky and felt the wind on their faces. They did not halt until they were out of bowshot of the walls. Dimrill Dale lay about them. The shadow of the Misty Mountains lay upon it, but eastwards there was a golden light on the land. It was but 1 hour after noon. The sun was shining, the clouds were white and high. They looked back. Dark yawned the archway of the gates under the mountain shadow. Faint and far beneath the earth rolled the slow drumbeats. Doom. A thin black smoke trailed out. Nothing else was to be seen. The dale all around was empty. Doom. Grief at last wholly overcame them, and they wept long, some standing and silent, some cast upon the ground. Doom, doom. The drumbeats faded.
Dude, excellent. Nice job, Clifford.
Thank you.
That was excellent.
So, oh man, so much to cover there, but Gandalf is gone.
I know, dude. Well, this was so epic that you almost don't, like, it was, and it was so exciting that it almost diminishes how sad it is that Gandalf fell and died, right? Because that was the most exciting part of the book we've read so far.
Yeah, I almost passed over it, I remember, the first time I read it, because it happens in just a single sentence.
You're, I know.
Like, wait, so they're all outside now. Wait, is Gandalf really not with them?
Yeah.
Was he just tripped by this thing?
Yeah, what? Seriously. Like, I mean, because up until this point, maybe the most exciting part was the flight to the ford where Frodo was crossing the river, you know, on Glorfindel's horse. But, I mean, this is just like, holy crap, Gandalf fell, and he's gone. If you actually focus on the words, because I mean at this point lots of people know, like, it's common knowledge what happens in the story and stuff, but like if you focus on the words here, like Frodo and Sam are just running away and they're weeping as they do, like this is a big deal, like, and this is like pretty horrifying.
Yeah
It's such like electric writing that you almost don't notice it. Yeah, he fell and like Gandalf's gone. Holy crap.
Yeah, and in some ways we've been talking a lot about like the weight of history at this point in the chapter, or at this point in the book, where they're surrounded by these references to past times, past societies, all these things.
Yeah,
it almost feels like there's like a reckoning. Like this Balrog is clearly something like out of the Silmarillion. I mean, literally we know it from the Silmarillion, not Lord of the Rings, but it's something like out of a deep dark past. You know,
yeah,
it feels like a little bit out of context with Frodo's flight to the ford, which is totally of the moment of this story. This is like suddenly Gandalf got sucked into some older mythology and yanked down into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like it happened so quick that it really is like kind of hard to believe. And I mean, everybody in the company, they thought it was unbelievable too. Like, I don't know, maybe you were reading through it and it's just like, all right, Gandalf's going to save the day, and they just keep going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he stops his big foe. That's another one to check off the list. But it's like, no. This is it. And after he falls, what? Aragorn and Boromir seem to be the only ones that can keep their heads. Because Boromir, what? He's like the most professional soldier out of all of them. If there's anybody that's experienced like total fear and catastrophe, it'd probably be him.
Uh-huh.
And then Aragorn, who's kind of, we're starting to get the feel like he's just a destined leader, right? Uh-huh. So he can lead them out. Don't let his last command go to waste, like get out of here as fast as you can, right?
Right.
So Aragorn's like, he keeps his head like, let's keep doing it, let's
uh-huh.
go.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I don't know, interesting, lots of stuff to talk about here. I think the first thing we should do is the Balrog.
Yes. What is this thing? Where did it come from?
Okay, so in typical Tolkien fashion, he treats us like we know what a Balrog is, okay? Legolas yells, oh no, here comes a Balrog and everything. And then Gandalf's like, oh, now I understand, without us understanding. We don't understand what a Balrog is.
Right?
If you've listened to the show, you might, because we've kind of hinted that this was going to be a Balrog, and then we've talked about Balrogs in other episodes, most notably probably the Gondolin special, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anyways, let's get to the bottom of the etymology of the Balrog and like what's his inspiration for this.
Okay.
All right, to understand the origin of the Balrogs, we got to look at a different word first. And so this word is going to be sigilware.
Okay.
Which is from the Old English poem called the Exodus. And so this Exodus poem, it's a paraphrased version of the book of the Bible. And I think this is probably like the first thing that spread to the Anglo-Saxon people from the Christian missionaries. Okay. So like when the Anglo-Saxon people conquered England, they weren't Christian, even though their predecessors had somewhat been Christian, which is kind of weird. But like the Anglo-Saxons needed Christianization again. So they needed missionaries to come to them. So before they had like all the books of the Bible, you know, because most of these people weren't literate. And like the Bible wasn't canonically formed yet. They had like this poem of the Exodus. And of course, the Exodus is about Moses and the parting of the Red Sea and the Hebrews leaving Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this poem mentions this Sigilware or Sigilwara people, Sigilwara land, you know, and this, so like the land of the Sigilware. And so most modern translators figured that the land of the Sigilware would have been the Ethiopians, who would have been in the far south where like the sun's really bright and then they have this dark skin.
Okay.
But Tolkien thought this was inaccurate. So he figured Sigil, the sigil part of this thing,
mm-hmm.
translates to either sun or jewel. Okay. But the, we call it, I've been calling it Sigilwera here, but like if you look at the asterisk word, you know, like the word that must have existed in some ancient unrecorded language, it would have been Sigil Hawara.
Okay.
In some ancient Germanic or Old English or something. And Hawara is related to the Latin word carbo. What does carbo mean? Take a guess.
I don't know.
All right. Elements. Carbo.
Fire. Carbon.
All right. Good. Earth. Carbon. Carbon. And so like in Latin, carbo means soot.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Like coal, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, this is quoting from Shippey. When an Anglo-Saxon of pre-literate Dark Age said Sigilwera, before any Englishman had ever heard of Ethiopia or the Book of Exodus, Tolkien believed that what he meant was rather the sons of Muspel, which is the old Norse fire giant who will bring Ragnarok, as opposed to, you know, Ethiopians with their, in quotes, black soot faces, you know, like, because I mean, Ethiopians just obviously darker skin. So Englishmen, they won't know about any, you know, sub-Saharan people in Africa, right? So like if they hear this word Sigilwera, you know, like sun and like burnt soot, you know, they're gonna think of not obviously, you know, humans. They're gonna think of like the evil monsters from the Norse mythology, which we're gonna touch on Ragnarok in some other episodes, and it'll be awesome. But Ragnarok is when, like, the Norse gods, which is, like, Odin and Thor, they end up, you know about Ragnarok, they end up losing Ragnarok, and they're going to get conquered by some fire demons, right? Or some like, fire gods. And, like, the head fire god, I think he's Surt, but they come from Muspelheim, so I guess, like, Muspel, I don't know, Tom Shippey would know more. But anyways, he's saying this Sigilwera is kind of like the basis of a Balrog. And so then there's this other line here from Shippey. He says, the idea of a fire spirit, which is what the sons of Muspelheim would be, because Muspelheim's like the fire god. The idea of the fire spirit reemerges in the brief glimpse of the orc chieftain who stabs Frodo with his sword face, his red tongue, and his eyes like burning coals. But it also gave Tolkien Durin's Bane, the Balrog. So I guess we're not quite getting into like the etymology of the word Balrog itself, but it comes from this Sigilwera word.
Okay, know? Interesting.
Yeah, and it's like based off that, like, you know, sun and burnt, you know, like this fire demon, like that's clearly the inspiration for the Balrog. Okay. All right. So this Balrog itself clearly doesn't take much of a stretch to say this is demonic, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And so now to give like a good history of the Balrogs. The Balrogs were made by Melkor himself.
Okay.
So remember from the music of Ainur, some of the Maiar, you know, like the lesser spirits, like the Ainurs, which are all angels. But some of they become the Maiar if they're not the Valar, right? And they come into Middle Earth. And the Maiar are just like the lesser gods, maybe like demigods, you'd say, I guess.
Right.
But some of them join Melkor, most notably like Sauron and stuff. But some of the ones that join him, Sauron puts their souls into them and they become Balrogs. So they're literally demons of Satan. Okay.
Okay. But they're like, their origins are like demigods.
Well, I mean, demons, at least in Christian theology, they were fallen angels.
Okay. You know?
So anybody that follows Melkor, who's an Ainur, is a fallen angel too. So
like, gotcha.
So they are literally demons.
But they're like at a level of in the food chain. They would be at the same level as like whatever's just below the Valar, the Maiar.
Correct. Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so now Gandalf, he's gonna lay down his life for his friends to escape. Obviously, sacrificial move. Like definition of sacrifice, right? And so this is one of the best scenes that highlights the emphasis in these books on the need for loyalty and self-sacrifice. You know, Gandalf stops on the bridge and he wants everybody else, you know, everybody else just instinctively waits for him. Like, you know, like we were reading lines, like they all halted within the doorways at the hall's end, right? And Aragorn and Boromir, they were ready to just run back for him too. But ultimately, Gandalf knows at this point, like he said before, he's met his match, okay? And Gandalf knows at this time, this is his time that he has to, you know, offer himself for his companions.
Okay.
Now, we promised to go over this in the music of Ainur. Gandalf was like, you know, he had like this spiel in front of the Balrog about like all this stuff. And of course, he mentions the secret fire. Yeah. Where have we heard secret fire before?
In the music of the Ainur?
Correct. Yeah, so Iluvatar put, like, the Seeker Fire into the world, and then all the Valar, like, the Valar and the Maiar all went into it, too.
It's what we were speculating was, like, Iluvatar's power of creation or something like that.
Exactly.
That so, Melkor sought after.
Yeah, so we promised, I think I said in that episode I'd promise to go over what this is. So this is an excerpt from one of Joseph Pierce's books. So let me just read this here. Because, again, this is just the best explanation of it. So let me just quote it and not get it wrong. So, the Seeker Fire is nothing less than the very God-given being of the cosmos itself, the spark of God's life and light in his creation. Therefore, Iluvatar gave to their vision being, set it amid the void, and the Seeker Fire was sent to burn at the heart of the world, and it is called Ea. The word Ea comes from the Elvish verb to be, the equivalent of the Latin esse, from which we derive essential, which means that it needs to be translated as being, or that which is. In another part of the Silmarillion, the word Ea emerges as the very word that God utters to bring the cosmos into being. Therefore I say Ea, let these things be, and I will send forth into the void the flame imperishable, and it shall be the heart of the world, and the world shall be. The parallels with the opening verses of Genesis are palpable. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth, and the earth was void and empty, and the darkness upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved over the waters. And God said, be light made, and light was made. Gandalf proclaims himself, therefore, to be a servant of the light of God, the flame imperishable, which is the very being of the cosmos itself. Even more explicitly, Tolkien told the American scholar Clyde C. Kibley that the Seeker Fire could liken to the Holy Spirit, thereby making Gandalf the venerable and self-proclaimed servant of the Christian God. If this is so, the fire would, of course, be secret because the fullness of the Christian revelation had not yet been shown forth in time. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess we haven't gotten that much background on Gandalf specifically.
Right.
But this implies that he's not just important and good, but he's like directly working for Iluvatar and the fire at the heart of the world. Like he's like defender of the world, basically.
Right. So like I don't want to quite get into like and reveal exactly what Gandalf's whole history and I don't know, physiology is, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, clearly he's explicitly an agent of Iluvatar if he's saying, like, I'm a wielder of the Seeker Fire,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Also interesting, though, just from, like, a conceptual level, you've got, like, a fire versus fire thing going on. Like, Gandalf wields the Secret Fire, servant of the Secret Fire, wielder of the Flame of Anor, versus the fire that is, like, the smoldering fire of the Balrog.
Right.
Which is like the evil fire. It's kind of like an interesting like good fire, bad fire thing going on.
But it definitely is.
Yes. That aside, I guess later in that same paragraph, he says the dark fire will not avail you, Flame of Udon. So it's like there's the Flame of Anor and the Flame of Udun, which I don't understand what those are references to, but suggests that there's like these two fires competing against each other.
All right. So Arnor, we just went over it. And what we were recording the last part, where Arnor is like kind of a...
It a typo? It says right here, Anor, not Arnor.
No, Anor.
Anor, okay.
They set up Minas Arnor, which again becomes Minas Tirith. And Arnor is like the word for... I don't know if it's the word for sun, but it's at least the word for setting sun. Okay. You know, and so that becomes Minas Tirith. So like Arnor's sun, whereas Udin is like... darkness. Which I don't know, I guess there's like an, you know, I guess if you think of like evil, there's evil fire as opposed to good, mm-hmm, fire, because like the good fire would be like the Holy Spirit. So like this is like Gandalf's a reference for the Holy Spirit, I'd, mm-hmm, say.
Okay.
You know, because in Christian theology, like at Pentecost, they all get like the tongues of flame, you know, and they can speak different languages, like Saint Peter and all the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of fire is it? It's like eternal fire, or like good consuming fire, you know, like kind of burning bush fire where it doesn't actually consume the thing, but it's just like, you know, it's just like invigorating, mm-hmm, you know, as opposed to like Sauron's fire, which just like leaves everything ash and like,
yeah,
destroyed,
yeah,
right? You know, like this is like the fire that's like just incorrigible,
mm-hmm,
right? Where, mm-hmm, it's like, and it's in your heart and you can't like just, you have to let it out, right? Yeah. I don't know how to describe it. You know, sorry I'm doing such a bad job.
So critically, when Gandalf and the Balrog actually clash, when it comes to blows, sword to sword, Gandalf wins, right?
Right.
Gandalf's sword, yeah, like, holds steady, basically, and the Balrog sword breaks. So it's, like, implies, like, the Gandalf, defender of the world, with Iluvatar somewhere on his side of things, has triumphed over this evil demon.
Right, but Gandalf still falls in.
Yeah, it's like a... It's kind of a sneaky... It's like a cheap shot, basically.
Well, so just to be clear, too, it's like, okay, we said Gandalf's an agent of Iluvatar. I don't really want to describe what he is, but anybody with half a brain cell can see that he's not just the old man that he appears to be, mm-hmm. right? This is just some sort of unassuming disguise. Fleming Rutledge notes in her book, like, this sort of journey cannot be made by mortals alone. Like, they need some sort of immortal help, right? And that's not just Legolas, who's an immortal elf.
Mm-hmm.
So in this moment, Gandalf, he's basically kind of emptying himself into submission of the rules of providence here. This is coming from Joseph Pierce's book. He's handing himself and his fellow companions and the whole fate of Middle-earth into the hands of the authority that ordains the rules. Okay, so that's God himself there. You know, so at this point, he's just like, he's trusting in providence. Like, he says, like, okay, I'm going to fight this Balrog, and then, like, it takes me in, but, like, I'm still trusting with that. Even with his last line, like, get out of here, you fools, right? Like, fly, you fools. But it is difficult to read this description of Gandalf's death without seeing parallels to Christ's submission of himself to the will of the Father on Golgotha, transforming Gandalf into a figure of the crucified Christ. So Gandalf's basically, I don't know, we're getting like kind of one of our first explicit references, like you can see this as like a Christ-like sacrifice. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Were you picking up on that?
Yeah, I suppose so. I was also thinking, like, there's something there in that he wins the battle but loses...
No, loses the battle, probably, I don't know, TBD about the
war. Well, yeah, I guess in this specific instance, though, he wins, like, the actual powers coming head-to-head, but then gets taken down by the cheap shot and pulled into the darkness. So it's like he didn't actually lose here. He's just been... He's been sucked in by this Balrog going down. So it's like a, I don't know, I guess that's the sacrifice right there.
Right.
It's like when it came to the strength of these fires, like the good fire beat out the bad fire, but he still had to sacrifice himself.
Well, I mean, but again, that's the same thing that happened on the cross when Jesus died. Like, okay, the devil killed God for 3 days, mm-hmm. you know, but ultimately that wasn't good mm-hmm. enough, according to Christian theology. Mm-hmm. I only got a couple things to wrap it up here. If you actually don't know anything about what comes next in The Lord of the Rings, I would tell you to stop this episode now. because this will just be a massive spoiler. But just a couple last notes on the drafts here. So Tolkien, like I said, he got to the Balin's tomb and then he kind of put down the book for like 2 years. But before he put it down, he still had some like rough sketches of an outline of what was to come. So from Balin's tomb, he had like this, just this is the only outline that we have still going for the book. They were pursued by goblins and Black Rider written above Balrog. After escaping from Balin's tomb, they come to the bridge of slender stone over the gulf. Gandalf turns back and holds off the enemy, apparently. They cross the bridge, but the Balrog leaps forward and wrestles with Gandalf. The bridge cracks under them, and the last they see is Gandalf falling into the pit with the Balrog. There is a flash of fire and blue light up from the abyss. Their grief. Trotter now guides the party. And then he puts in parentheses, of course, Gandalf must reappear later. Probably fall is not as deep as it seems. Gandalf thrusts Balrog under him, and so, then there's something undecipherable, and eventually... Following the subterranean stream in the gulf, he found a way out. But he does not turn up until they have had many adventures, not indeed until they are on the borders of Mordor and the King of And is being beaten in battle. And so then Christopher Tolkien notes that it seems to show clearly that before ever the story of the fall of Gandalf from the Bridge of Khazad Dûm was written, my father had fully intended that he should return. And that is how he ends this volume of the History of Middle-earth, which is the 6th of 12. So, big deal. Anybody that says, like, Gandalf coming back is just lazy writing, That is proof against you right mm-hmm. there. All right, Clifford, we're back for another one.
Mm-hmm.
How was your week?
It was good. Got news that quarantine is extended, at least mm-hmm. here in California. So, mm-hmm. yeah, hunkering down to just keep on keeping on. Nice. But other than that, nice weather here. Everything's blooming. Feeling a little bit like Lothlorien, maybe.
Although hey, we haven't gotten yet.
Sorry,
we haven't gotten there yet. I don't have any. I don't have any corrections. So I guess we did a good job with this chapter.
Cool.
Actually, on second thought, I'm not sure I've listened to it fully, so I'm not done editing it. Anyways, okay, dude, I started making pizza.
Oh, like, sweet!
From scratch.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I know.
That's like one of the best things to make at home.
Yeah,
it's like mind-blowing how good it is, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to do my best Southside imitation of it. And cool. then, you know, like a real Chicagoan, I cut it in squares. And everybody freaked out. But then it's like, I was actually thinking about, like, most Chicago pizzas, not just, like my part of time, but, like, most Chicago pizzas, like, if you try to do triangles, that would be, like, the floppiest thing of all time.
I feel like I've seen a lot of deep dish and triangles.
No, deep dish and triangles. No, I'm talking about, like, just the other kind of Chicago pizza, like just the Chicago's thin crust pizza, like all of them just overloaded with toppings and they have a very weak crust.
That's fair.
Like there's no way it couldn't be in not squares.
The one you like from Fox's, that's like the super greasy, it's like it's thick dough too, right?
The gold standard. Yeah, but I mean it's pretty thin though. Like
it's like a medium crust.
No, because it doesn't even have real crust on the outside. What it does have, though, and this is, I made it two nights in a row because I still have dough left over. What it does have is the sand on the bottom.
Which the cornmeal?
Yes, I've been informed that's cornmeal. so I started cooking with that yesterday, and that enhanced it too. So I'm starting to get the dough down a little bit, except I can't find yeast. Like, I thought I bought yeast.
It's impossible to find.
Yeah, can't find it. I don't think I really need it, though. For my pizza. Actually, I think it would help with flavor. I don't need it to rise at all, though.
Really?
No. I don't know. Okay. I think I had it kind of close. Maybe you could do with a little rise, but no.
Okay.
Yeah. Dude, did you watch the... have you been watching the Michael Jordan documentary?
No,
or,
I haven't.
Sorry, the Last Dance documentary? It's kind of about the whole team.
Oh, cool. No, I haven't.
Oh, it's awesome, dude. You got to get on it.
Okay.
The third episode ended with... It's about, like, their 1998 season, which was the last one that they won.
Uh-huh.
And it ended with Dennis Rodman about to go on a 48-hour bender. And he walks out of the game dressed in, like, head-to-toe, like, a biker gang guy.
Uh-huh.
Hops on, drinks a Miller Lite, and then hops on a motorcycle and drives right out the stadium. It was pretty awesome.
That's hilarious.
Do you remember Michael Jordan?
I mean, not really, honestly.
Yeah,
I remember hearing about him as a kid, but I never watched any of the games when I was little.
Right. So I remember I learned what tattoos were by watching Dennis Rodman.
Okay.
And then I remember going to one game when I was four. It must have been in 1998 when Michael Jordan was playing.
That's cool.
That's a good memory for me since I was only born in 1994.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
Yeah, we're in the same boat there. Yeah, I don't know. That's about it for me for the week.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, then, yeah, let's just get out of here. Everybody have a good week. Stay safe in the quarantine, in the pandemic times.
Yep. Thanks, y'all.